G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. It is recorded on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. This program goes to Bakery Hill, Ballarat, the site in 1854 of the Monster Meeting of Miners, where the Eureka flag was first raised and the Eureka Oath was first intoned. The meeting was called in response to the mining licences fee and police harassment of the miners who had joined the gold rush at the Ballarat fields. The oath, "We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties." It is seen as the first defining moment in Australian democratic process. The Reclaim the Eureka Spirit Movement holds the Eureka Medal ceremony each year on the 3rd of December, honouring those people who have stood firm to the principles of solidarity but who do not take the limelight. It is the alternative order of Australia. It is also interesting to note that present-day Bakery Hill is surrounded by a barrage of cars in a roundabout with McDonald's to the right.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. I've noticed that five of the six recipients are here, and I'll talk about the person who hasn't been able to make it.
Thank you, Dr. Joseph. Comrades, Ballarat Regional Trades and Labor Council is proud to nominate Dick Ryan for the Eureka Australia Medal. Dick has been and still is an active union member for over the last 58 years. Between 1967 and 1968, Dick was a member of the Amalgamated Metalworkers Union in England. Dick came to Australia in 1972 and joined the Marine Stewards Union in 1974, holding temporary office bearer roles within the union and was relieving National Secretary for about 8 months. In 1985, the Tasmanian Liberal government sacked all the Marine Stewards while working away in Germany. The Tasmanian government singled out Dick to be banned from the industry. After a successful arbitration at the Commission, Dick ended up serving a 6-month suspension and was reinstated. In 1989, Dick became the Assistant Branch Secretary of the Seamen's Union Victoria Branch. Until the Seamen's Union amalgamated with the Waterside Workers Federation, forming the Maritime Union of Australia, or the MUA. In 1998, Dick was Assistant Secretary of the MUA, the Howard government, during the Howard government wharf dispute. Dick, along with all the other MUA workers, were sacked for 101 days. In 2018, Dick joined the Australian Services Union and was the main force in organising the school crossing supervisors, where he still works today. Dick has played a major role in the union and community fundraising, starting the grand final breakfast fundraisers, which keeps going today and is split between unions and helping underprivileged kids. And this event has been going for the last 24 years. And between all of that, Dick also organised security for Nelson Mandela when he came to visit Australia. So, do you want to have a few words there, Dick? Well done.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the people who's original landowners of this part where we're standing here today, both their elders past, present and in future. 1854 was when the rebellion started here. And it was a sign that people saying to the governments of the day that we want to have a say in what happens to us and what we're going to be prepared to cop and what we're not prepared to cop. I want to say, firstly, it's a great honour and a pleasure for me to accept this medal. And I want to thank Angela and the executive of the Ballarat Trades and Labour Council for nominating me for this. But I've got to be honest, if my dear old mother was alive, she'd clip me round the ear. because you always thought, well, you know, you do things for people, but you don't expect to get rewarded for it, and don't ever think you're going to do things that you should do for your own advantage. So, sorry, Mum, but this is what's happened. Despite what Angela said before, I just want to say that 1985, we was selected to go and pick up the Able Tasman, which was going to replace the old Empress of Australia in the Bass Strait Run. And I got told by a member of the Greens from Tasmania that when we get over there, the Tasmanian government's going to pick a blue with the Stewards Union, and we're all going to be sacked because they were behind in the polls. Well, anyway, that certainly happened. We refused to sack. We were there for a month. And I got a phone call one morning from the ABC in Hobart. Said, do you realise Premier Gray has called you a thug, a gun runner, a drug dealer, and Christ knows what else? I said, well, tell him to get outside Parliament and say it, and we'll see how he goes from there. And needless to say, he refused. In 1998, we had the Wharf dispute, which again was concocted by the Liberal Party and the government under John Howard. And that went for 101 days here in Melbourne. It was shorter in other states, but it was 101 days here in Victoria. And I had the dubious honour of having to take home a scab. What happened was Greg Convey, who was the Secretary of the ACT at the time, rang up the union rooms and said, there's one of these scabs wants to come over and tell the truth about what's happened, how they got involved. Can we hide him? And I had to hide him. I was living down in a place called Granford at the time, and I had to take him over the weekend. And I walked in the door and my late wife said to me, who's this bloke? And I explained it to her. I said, this bloke's a scab, he's come over. She said, he's not getting fed here. So for the whole weekend, I had to feed him fish and chips. But what he said to me was, and I honestly believe that young kid, what happened was they advertised for people to go and work on the wharves in a different project to what the wharfies were doing. And they all signed up, and when they realised afterwards that they was actually scabbing on us, there was nothing they could do about it because the government had ex-army people in there that were standing over them and making sure they didn't leave the desk. So that's the sort of stuff the Liberals get up to when working people. And as I said, it started in 1854 with the miners, and it's never stopped. But I just want to finish up on two things that impressed me in my life from speeches. One was with John F. Kennedy in his inauguration, when he said, don't ask what the country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And I put that around as, don't ask what the union can do for you, but ask what you can do for the union. And the second one was, in 1987, I was up in Sydney and we were leaving in the Marine Stewards office, and we had to go to a retirement party for a bloke called Tom Stuper from the Wharfies. And the last speaker was the then National Secretary of the Builders Workers Industrial Union, as it was, Pat O'Shea. And what Pat O'Shea said was really a mind-boggler. He said, all the speakers before me have wished Tom all the best in his retirement. He said, well, I don't. And he said, the reason I don't is because when you're born into the working class, you're part of the struggle from the cradle to the grave. And that's never been a truer word said in my books. Once again, I'd like to thank Angela and the Trades All and everybody and Dr. Joe for this wonderful award. And I'll never, ever forget it. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, I've got an apology for, and I'll say a few words for Eve Scarf. Now, Eve Scarf is in her late 80s, and she rang me last night upset. She lives in a nursing home, and she was coming today, but she developed a fever, and she sent her apologies. But Eve was a member of the International Peace Brigades for over 30 years, and she was a human shield in Central America in the 80s and 90s and the early first decade of the 21st century. What that meant is, at that particular point in time, in Guatemala, Honduras, all those places you hear about political extrajudicial executions, she would attend meetings because there's always questions asked when a European is killed, because she's got both British and Australian citizenship, and she would sometimes stay in the homes of union leaders and activists who are targeted for assassination. Now that's what I call an extraordinary human being. Now, I've interviewed her on Radical Australia a few weeks ago, and if you want to learn more about her, if you look at the podcast, Eve Scarf. So we're going to do a ceremony for her in Melbourne when she gets better, but she sends her apologies, and she'd like to wish you all a happy Eureka Day. She was very distressed when I spoke to her last night. But I would like to call on Vasalia Govindu to come up here. Thank you. She has devoted many, many years to the plight of injured workers who are stood over, harassed by the workers' compensation scheme. And the fact these major changes that have been made recently have made it much more difficult for workers. So I'd like to present this to you, and I would like you to say lots of words.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you, Rosie, for nominating me for this award. So IWST has 572 injured workers from right across Australia. 80% are predominantly from Victoria. I started helping injured workers in 2012, initially in my role as a health and safety representative, because I couldn't understand, you know, when people get injured at work, the claim should be accepted because our system is a no-fault system. So I supported injured workers in my designated work group by basically providing them with risk assessments, minutes of meetings where, you know, the hazards were identified and there was no risk control in place. And we started getting claims accepted, but we also started getting quicker return to work rates. So when I left my DWG in 2020, after 20 years as a HSR, there was no one on workers' comp. In 2021, during COVID, we started injured workers support team with two other injured workers, because what we found is there was no place for injured workers to go to come together and find support. So we initially started off as what we would term as PPE. So a kind of, you know, a protective equipment for injured workers in that we'll come together on our weekly Zooms, try and get some solutions. IWST starts navigating with you from day one of your injury. We've represented injured workers at the Workplace Injury Commission. We now started representing workers at arbitration. And all of this is on a purely volunteer basis on top of the 40 hours of paid work that I do. Injured workers is my second family. We've learned to navigate the workers' comp system, and especially the changes that came into place last year in 2024. For us, the last 12 months has been absolutely challenging, where, you know, claims which are supported by numerous amount of information is being rejected because WorkSafe agents and the Workplace Injury Commission do not understand OHS obligations. We've actually had health and safety reps who have been injured and past the 52 weeks now find themselves without jobs, not because they did the wrong thing. It was because they raised the concern that I got injured at work and someone else didn't do their job. So getting this award was an absolute surprise, so thank you, Rosie. But it's an important one. It actually, you know, tells us that we need to do more to empower injured workers. There's so much of gaps in the system, and injured workers are left on their own to navigate this. It seems like when you want to, you know, navigate workers' comp, you need to have a degree or some kind of certification in understanding workers' comp. Now, someone that's got anxiety and depression who can't even think about the next day, how do they think about what information do I need to provide to the IME? How do they think about, okay, there's gaps in my certificate, you know, in my COC. Do I remind my doctor to make sure that they filled in or ticked in those boxes? What we need is advocacy. Injured workers need someone to walk beside them from day one they put the claim in. But also what we need is we need a change in the legislation. We need it to become a fair, transparent, honest, accountable system. And we can't do that alone. So to every one of you here today, please support our petition. It's on the Victorian Parliament webpage. It's calling to change this current system, to make one that's fair, that's honest, that's transparent, that's accountable, but one that puts the injured worker in the center of workers' comp. Thank you very much. And thank you again, Joe.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
We're at Bakery Hill in Ballarat, Victoria on the 3rd of December at the ceremony conferring the Order of Eureka to those unsung heroes of solidarity.
I mean, most people, you know, they switch on TV or go on the net and push a button, like something, and don't do anything about it. And that's the problem of the 21st century. A lot of people think they know a lot of things, but very few people come out and put their head above the parapet. Now, I'd like to call on Nancy Atkin to come up.
Hang on, have I got it right? Reclaim the radical spirit of the Eureka Rebellion for this really important occasion, this important work. Reminding us what Eureka should be remembered. And just before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners, the Wadawurrung people, and the land we stand on. In accepting the medal, which I'm, or when I accept the medal, I really commend the intent of the organisers in recognising people who history doesn't necessarily take notice of, the unsung heroes and the many thousands and of activists who over the years have changed Australia for the better and have fought to correct injustices like we just heard. And just to going back to my first example of activism, I'd like to remind people about the anti-Vietnam War campaign. And that's an example where history nowadays seems to be remembered in terms of maybe the big historic events and a very few leaders who were important at the time. They were wonderful people. But the whole campaign with thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people coming out on the streets all over Australia was not just due to a few leaders. It was due to many people like probably anyone here present who was around at that time who organised people to go to meetings, go to demonstrations, lobby parliamentarians, get a government in power that would end the war. And in my case, I was a student. We organised street theatre, we organised protests and so on and so forth. And these people, many have disappeared from the official history, and it's really a surprise to me that historians haven't just gone round and talked to people who were active at the time, because they're not hard to find. There are many, many of them who probably have many things to say about campaigns like that. And just touching on a few other campaigns I've been involved in, that, and I'll pick out the ones that are obvious here today. I mean, the antenna on Marion's T-shirt for 3CR was built by radio engineer volunteers who had learned how to make radio stations during their role in the Vietnam War, where they were running around organising underground radio channels, illegal radio channels at the time. And then they came on and became the initial radio engineers and studio builders at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, which is a fabulous example of something that over the years has involved thousands of people, not just in broadcasting, but in administration and in building and maintaining the building where the radio station is organised. And just one more thing I've added in that I think is an example of where the work of trade unions and of activists has been most important. And we just heard about the really bad things that are happening in WorkSafe and the need for ongoing advocacy and support for injured workers. But back in the early 80s, I was lucky enough to be given a job as organiser for the Workers' Health Action Group. And that was when the initial laws were passed, which put a stop to blaming workers for their accidents and recognised that the employers had a responsibility for health and safety, and brought in the system of health and safety reps, which we've heard about today. And that important change was put through Parliament with in a situation where the Minister for Industry or Labour, whatever it was a former official of the Amalgamated Metal Workers Union. And that's an example of how years and years of work by working class people and their representatives resulted in a massive change in the law, even though there's still much to be done today. So that's probably enough for me. Thanks for the invite, Joe, and thanks for organising the event.
Now, Robert celebrated his 80th birthday, and his wife, Mary, told me he spoke for 35 minutes at his 80th birthday. So if he goes on for too long, Mary's going to come up and lead him off the stage.
My own awakening started, as someone has previously said, was during the Vietnam War, when I was at university and I was opposed to the Vietnam War. And the New Zealand troops, because I was living in New Zealand at the time, had gone to be part of that war. And there was headlines in the newspaper, "First kill to the New Zealand regiment." And so that really incensed me. And I wrote my first letter to the newspaper at that time, objecting to that kind of headline and to the participation of New Zealand in the Vietnam War. Since then, I've been lucky. I've served in the Solomon Islands, where I helped the indigenous people to, I had to simplify all those mission European type structures so that the indigenous people of the Solomon Islands could take over and lead their own church. And it was a privilege to be part of that during the 1970s. After that, I was briefly in New Zealand and came to Australia in 1979. And my first job was to be the consultant for social justice with the Uniting Church in Perth. And in that position, we had to take some action, particularly against someone like Sir Charles Court, who wanted to make sure that if they said mining could go ahead, then mining could go ahead, even if the indigenous people objected. And on one of the places called Nookambar, in 1981, the Aboriginal people objected to the AMAX oil company going on drilling for oil on that particular piece of land. But Sir Charles Court made sure that a convoy of 60 oil drilling trucks was escorted by police onto that station against the will of the Aboriginal people. Myself, four other clergymen and about 20 Aboriginal people slept the night on the road to try and stop that convoy. We were found by the police during the night, and in the morning we were arrested and taken about 70 kilometres to Fitzroy police station, where we were kept in jail for the day. It meant about 10 days in court, where we proved the government wrong. We proved that they didn't gazette the road properly. That was the private road into Nookambar station. They used that as a reason why they could arrest us on a road, and we proved that they never did that, so we weren't lawfully being arrested. And then I was also accused of resisting arrest, and I proved in court, because they had videoed everything, that passive resistance does not constitute resisting arrest. So that's sort of been part of my notoriety. Since then, I've been the National Director for Social Justice for the Uniting Church and involved in many of the issues there, particularly unemployment. We opposed BHP and Ok-Tedi, where they opened that mine, that copper mine in Papua New Guinea, and just threw the tailings down the river, which then overflowed and covered the jungle. And so BHP actually flew us up there to show us how bad it was. But we certainly tried to make it clear that that was not the right thing to do in PNG. And in more recent times, well, I've been involved in the struggle, but particularly the struggle of West Papua. I'm known as the chaplain of the West Papua office. I have visited West Papua twice, and I will continue to make sure that the concerns that the Indonesian government and their savage military occupation of West Papua is well known. Unfortunately, because of diplomatic relationships, Australia as a government doesn't want to take action. But I think it is time that we noted the situation of our Indigenous people in the most immediate country to Australia in West Papua. And so I am proud to be part of the tradition in bringing attention to that particular cause and making it known to anyone who's willing to listen. So I'd like to thank you, Joe, and the committee. I'm privileged to be able to receive one of these medals, and I commit myself to keep on going to stir the pot wherever I can.
That's it for Stick Together this week. If you want to catch up with our program, the podcast is available at 3cr.org.au or at your favourite podcast site. You can contact the producers of the show at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or by ringing 03 9419 8377 and giving us a message. My name's Annie McLaughlin. Remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there is a union for you, and until next time, stick together.
From every corner of the world, they came from all around. When in 1851 they struck gold upon the ground, every voyage was a long one, months upon the stormy sea. Some to seek their fortune, others escaping slavery. What they found on the gold fields was rule by brutish thugs, discrimination and taxation mixed with swinging billy clubs. The gold was getting scarcer and cops were getting worse. The diggers burned their licenses and vowed to end this curse. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. The crown tried to divide them, giving preference to some. The diggers wouldn't have it. They said it's all of us or none. They built a stockade while the redcoats massed nearby, and they heard the miners shouting, "We're ready now to die." The rebel miners waited for whatever lay in store, and on one December morning in 1854, the redcoats attacked the camp. Dozens there would fall amongst these brave gold diggers who'd risen to the call. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. The army thought it was over and things would go their way.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.